CliffCentral.com.
All right, so there are a couple of things that have come up out of this thing with Dr. Hanan, and there's somebody who said here that there's some very powerful messages this morning, Rolene. You know what? Like, this idea of quality over quantity is a very big deal. And we were talking just now about poor old Leanne's cat. She had to put the cat down last week, just straight after the show where we spoke about it. So
yeah, it was actually two shows ago.
I'm sorry.
We said, I pulled it up to the screen and said, it's probably the last time you'll see her.
And we were like, you gotta take that cat to the vet.
Say goodbye.
Yeah, shame. She was not, she was old.
Yeah, she was 16. Oh. And
yes.
I took her an hour later. So that actually helped me make the decision. You guys actually really helped me there.
Okay.
Took her, and then she had quite a dramatic time there.
Uh-oh.
Her blood sugar, blood pressure was really low. And the way you euthanize an animal is to give them an overdose of an anesthetic. But because her blood pressure was so low, it wasn't circulating around her body. So she couldn't die. Eventually, the vet administered a sedative, and she kind of started falling asleep, but not much. So that was pretty traumatic for me, I must say. She eventually had to take her to the back and inject straight into the jugular.
Jeez, so it took a long time for her to
and
go.
You know what was crazy about this cat is I was adopting a dog, I think, from Kitty and Puppy Haven at the time. And this cat was annoying us by jumping onto the table. I was trying to sign papers. Mm. I said, what is this cat? What is it doing? They said, oh, that's Sheba. She's older than the other cats. We've brought her here because she's very poorly and she's like trying to die. But she
that
just
was years ago.
That was when she was a kitten. So I said, well, I'll take her home and let her die with me.
Oh, sure.
16 years later.
And she was still poorly at the end.
And she still wouldn't die when we were trying to let her go.
Oh, my God. She really didn't want to die.
No.
But you know, I do sometimes think that it would be a welcome thing for people to be able to do the same thing.
100%.
Again, to go back to quality versus quantity, if someone is really like Paul Biya, the president of Cameroon, who we saw earlier, someone should take him in the back and directly into the jugular. Like, let the guy go. It's done. You're 90.
He doesn't want to be there.
He doesn't want to be there. He's farting without knowing he's farting. He doesn't know whether he's at a presidential summit or in his kitchen having tea with his wife. I mean, really.
Yeah.
I feel like it is the kind thing to do. Right?
That's the word. It's the kind of thing to do, but you can't.
And I'm not
kill
saying
people.
Against their will. I'm not saying you drag people into the back room and like take care of them when they're still happy and healthy and full of life.
Bring your mother-in-law and say she's feeling poorly, she wants to go.
But if someone is at the end and it's just painful to be alive, like why keep that going just for quantity as opposed to quality.
Yeah, exactly.
If you had to ask most people, they would want it that way at the end anyway. I would.
Like, imagine you're in pain, you drink like 9 kinds of meds, and it's just misery.
Misery, right?
You're putting a huge burden on your family.
And you're conscious enough to say, exactly, huge financial burden because hospitals aren't cheap. And you also say, like, you're very conscious to say, I don't want this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
My gran always used to say, she would point out other old ducks and say, when I get to that, please just shoot me.
It's like some lady shuffling through the old age home and she's like, don't let me get like that one.
Yeah. And then shame. She was at the stage where food was kind of falling out of her mouth and she was pointing at similar woman going, when I get to that age, then you must just put me down.
Oh, it would be difficult, huh?
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to do, but it wasn't easy taking your cat there.
No, it was horrible. 2 weeks I cried ago. The whole way through.
Sure.
The vet held my hand. I just, you know, you feel kind of embarrassed when it happens. But that animal has been with you for so long and you've developed a closer bond with them than a lot of humans.
Mm. Must be tough to be a vet though and people like you and me and, you know, people who just love their pets keep coming in and then you have to help them, have them put down, and you have to be the first person they talk to about it. And, it's got to be tough.
You do get used to it to a certain degree. I mean, there's a whole process, and because I've had to put down so many animals, and the family often say to me, Leanne, you need to come and put this
help me. Yeah.
at our vet, they light a candle in the reception, so everyone knows not to like scream with joy at new puppies while you're putting down your cat.
So everyone knows that when there's a...
they know when you go in. They let you go in before just to spend some time. And then the whole process is explained to you every time. And it's so funny, you know the process, but the explanation soothes you. Mm. And then when you leave, you don't pay. You pay via EFT afterwards. You just go straight to your car.
Mm.
The tissues are there. You know, it's like a whole...
You see, they've thought about it. That's actually, it's amazing. Like that's such a considerate way of doing things. Imagine the first thing after you've put your... All right, that'll be 5,000 rand.
Yeah, exactly. Like, well, you're broke now.
It's about 1,500 rand to do that. And then the worst is they always say to me, do you want their... Just before they put them down, do you want their ashes? Mm. And I know that's about 4,000 rand. I'm like, no, thank you.
My friend of mine just recently put down his dog and the vet refused to do it.
Why?
I don't know. The dog had like cancer of some kind. The heart was enlarged. And then they'll recover. Take this medicine for 3,000 bucks.
Mm-mm.
And then my friend is like, but I can see the dog is in pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, that's another thing with my vet. They've learned that sometimes I can't afford to go the extra step. Yes, she could have had scopes and gone to another vet for.
But imagine having these conversations about humans, because some people are very, very anti euthanasia, right?
Yeah. Mm.
A lot of people have a big problem with it. They're like, you can't play God. It's not your place. And we shouldn't be allowed to do this. I mean, there are places like Switzerland, for example, where they have laws that allow you to do this. Very, very strict rules. You have to have a living will and all that stuff. But you can do it there.
Yeah.
Some other parts of the world, they don't allow you to do it. I have a fundamental problem with it.
I don't understand that. It's like anti-choice. I don't get it. If you have an adult and you can prove that they're in their faculties, why can't they make that choice?
You own your meat, right? You own your own meat vehicle. So you should be allowed.
Your meat vehicle.
If you have a car and it has a puncture, you sell it.
Yeah, this is your meat vehicle. Yeah.
I need to get from A to B. Where's your meat vehicle?
Well, Michelle says she works at a vet, and I can tell you I cry with 90% of the owners who come in to put their pets down. Mm.
Honestly, it doesn't get it. You can't get over it. You can't get desensitized unless there's something wrong with you.
Matthew says euthanasia is wrong. So explain why you think that, Matthew. I'm not going to fight with you. I want to know genuinely why it would be. Like, what's the best argument against it?
Again, we're not killing like healthy people here.
No.
Yeah.
And the people themselves have written down what state they'd like to be in if they still want to be alive, and what state they'd like to be in if they don't want to be alive anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I think, and often I've had this conversation with friends of mine. Would you rather lose your mind or lose your body? Like, you'd have such physical problems that you like had to wear an adult nappy and all that stuff, or go completely dilly, not know where you are, because one of them is going to go first, right? Which is worse, do you think?
So my mind.
The mind's the worst.
You think that's the worst?
Yeah, I know for sure from just experience and seeing people in my mom's condition where it's one or the other.
Sure.
And my mom is in a wheelchair. She's also incontinent. She can't walk, but her mind's there 100%, and she laughs every day. She's with it.
Yeah, like, so my granddad had a stroke, and then but he fully recovered, but he felt trapped in his body for that like 6 months or so. It's like you think I can do something, but you physically can't. You used to be able to carry your own tea, but now someone's feeding you. It just breaks you mentally.
It is very, very difficult. But it's easier for people around you when it's the other way around. Matthews replied.
He says, would you abort a child that's 9 months old?
It's not the child. We're not talking about someone who doesn't have a decision.
No.
We're talking someone healthy.
I don't think that's particularly right either. And I don't think that – listen, these are tough questions. These are actually the most difficult questions you could – possibly
like,
have.
Why would you consider quality of life? It's like even the question with like right to choice. If I can prove to you that your child has this gene that will develop into, like, okay, granted,
an arm growing out of their head.
Exactly.
A palm?
An arm.
Like an arm growing out of their head that will affect their brain in a certain way, and they'll die probably. They'll be in pain for the first 3 years of their lives, and at 9 they'll die.
Yeah.
mean, they could have told my mom I might have had three legs, which I ended up having. And then just think if she made the decision to get rid of me.
Well, then we wouldn't have you on the show. The only part that I'd be upset about is it would be you on the show.
But again, Leanne, like, I think emphasis on decision.
Yeah.
It should be a choice. The government or someone can't tell you no.
Yeah, I don't think so. So if the authority to decide whether or not you want to still be around doesn't vest with you, who does it vest with? It should not be the church or the government or any of those things, because those people are at an arm's length or more away from you.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you could say that it vests with the family.
I think family and medical professionals.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, look, medical professionals didn't exactly cover themselves in glory during COVID, so I'm not sure they're the best people to ask anymore. They might have once been. They were unassailable, you could argue, in terms of their opinions before. That's not so true anymore. I don't know. I don't know the answers. Matthew says, though, a life is a life, a heartbeat's a heartbeat. So you just want to give up because life is harder than what it used to be. That's a good question because, and this is why I'm interested in Matthew's opinion on this. The people who are against euthanasia and the people who have an argument that, you know, life itself is precious and that we do not have the right to decide when that life begins or ends. We don't, it's none of our business, really. You know, you come in that there's a date at the beginning of your life on the tombstone and there's a date at the end. But you could argue, if you are a complete maniac, you could argue that if you're poor, shouldn't you be able to euthanize you? Let's say you just are desperately, desperately poor. Now you get into dangerous territory, right?
You do get into dangerous territory the minute you start, like, what do you call this thing? The minute you start defining what is quality of life, because, yeah, that can be independent from person to person.
Not only that, but your belief in
a deity,
in a deity, and in hope, and in even an if afterlife, it's fate, whatever, even if it's just fate, like, no, we can't turn the machines off because maybe an angel will come down and change things.
Yeah, could happen, and some people really believe that, and for them, that's a good reason to keep on going. Simpiwe, our own Simpiwe, says, my grandmother has dementia and watching her mental state deteriorate has been the worst thing to watch. Whew, that is tough. Dave, responding to Simpiwe, says, my gramps' mind is fading, but his heart still responds to a hug and a smile. Sure, man. That's just so tough. What do you do? You know, is Leanne's cat better off because she could make the decision for? Of course.
But you see, there's another argument. I kept that cat in a safe environment. If it was out in the wild, it would have died a long time ago. But because I took that cat out of its natural environment and nurtured it for so long, I made it live so long that it became very ill in old age. So it's actually my fault that it's old and decrepit.
And therefore you have to...
And therefore I have to end it too.
You've done a lot of thinking on this. You would have, right?
Okay, like, if we're doing that thought process, it gets pretty dark very quickly. Mm-hmm. So, like, guardrails in society are keeping people alive past animal instinct.
I mean, not even animal, more like...
Nature.
With these prolonged lives that we're living now because of medical science, you consider that the average human lifespan was a lot shorter just 100, 200 years ago. Maybe we get 100 years now instead of 60 or 70 or 80, but those last 10 or 20, not so great.
I don't know. Have you seen the Golden Bachelor?
No, what's the Golden Bachelor?
So it's the Bachelor series. It's the Bachelor Nation.
But it's old people.
It's okay, so he...
This is fantastic.
I think he's like close to 70.
Yeah.
I've never found myself saying that's a really good-looking man at the age of 70, but he really is.
Yeah.
And these women are unbelievable. They're in their 60s and they just have taken care of themselves. If you tell me that I could look like that and be like that and feel that way, because they're so vital, all of them.
Yeah.
They're fit and they exercise.
The Golden Bachelor.
Yes.
This is a thing. I gotta look this up.
It's like The Bachelor, The Bachelorette.
Sooner or later, we're going to have like a baby bachelor.
The Golden Bachelor, huh? It's an actual show. I'm just looking at it now.
It's in the Bachelor series.
I thought they canceled.
Instead of The Bachelor this year or The Bachelorette, it's The Golden Bachelor.
I thought they canceled The Bachelor after the antebellum thing.
it'll never be cancelled. They'll always find a way of coming back.
Isn't that interesting? So the guy's name is what? Jerry Turner. Is that right?
You say, how do you spell
Gary,
his name?
G-E-R-R-Y.
You actually say it as Gary.
Gary.
Yeah.
And he's in his 70s, you say?
I think.
Okay, let me show everybody a picture of this guy.
A good-looking man, as Leanne.
Yeah, I mean, so Leanne says this
is... he's such a nice guy.
Great-looking dude. And clearly, I mean, he does say in this article that I found, he regrets having gone on that show.
Oh, wait, but don't give me any spoilers.
Okay, well, I'm not going to. So there, it's still on.
It says spoilers. Oh, no, don't.
Okay, no, I won't make you... let me show you a picture of what he looks like. So for those people, here's the Golden Bachelor, everybody.
Can't even look.
That guy's in his 70s? Wow.
Yeah, that's a good-looking man.
I mean, come on, 70. Guys.
Wow. Okay, good for
and
him.
He's possibly the nicest human being I've ever known. He's an amazing grandfather. He's just such a nice human. Compared to the young guys and young women that are on the normal series,
yeah.
He's just the respect he has. And the women are amazing because they're so self-confident. They've lived so many years. They're oozing this confidence.
Yeah. You see, there's something very attractive about that. There's something very, very attractive about someone who's comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah. And that's what you're seeing is this.
Yeah.
And they're so sensitive to each other's needs. It's like...
No, I totally get it. Roxanne says, I'm going to be the Golden Bachelorette.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, well, there we go.
So if you tell me I'm going to live that life and be like that and live to 100 with new ways of medicine, then I'm willing to go that way. It's too late for me now.
I mean. Why? You could get into... No, you could. You could do this now.
Yeah.
You got... So 60 is how long away for you? 15 years?
Yeah.
So come on. 15 years. You could do a lot of things in 15 years. You could. Years. Get a lot changed. Get those titties done.
You've always told me never to.
Get no, a nip of course and tuck.
No, but I mean,
that was way back.
But you could. I mean, there's stuff we could all do.
Yeah.
To improve, and you think about these people who are like they're on a dating show in their 60s and 70s. Like, why the hell not? Right.
Amazing.
But I don't know. Like, so
you just,
this
you just want to have them all put down.
No. It's this quality of life thing, Gareth.
Okay,
like,
go on. I'm
trying to figure out. So. Okay, cool. Let's say you shoot up like 9 different types of drugs or 9 different types of steroids. Is that still quality of life if I'm functioning optimally?
Mm-mm.
But it's just that like for that 1 hour, I'm a zombie and then I shoot up all this stuff and then I'm functioning. Is that still quality of life?
Clearly not, because I think that if you need that much medicine, if you need that much stimulant to keep you awake and alive, I don't know that your life is good.
But isn't that like self-improvement and also like... keeping you alive, keeping you going till 100?
I think that there are just some people who have unbelievable good reserves genetics, of energy and good genes.
Yeah, good genes.
But energy, like I know some people who are slow and tired and finished in their 20s. Mm. And then I know people in their 70s who've got so much energy that they could basically start again. They really could. They could start
their
whole life
again. Back again, yeah.
And I wonder... where that comes from.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't come from caffeine or steroids or any of that shit. It comes from somewhere else.
Isn't it that thing where you use the blood of young people, exsanguinate them?
Jocelyn says, please don't call us old in our 60s. I still feel like I'm 40-something. Well, that's, you know, they say the 60s, the new 40 or whatever. Mm. I don't know how they keep revising these numbers down.
Yeah.
But it is possible. And listen, it's a miracle of modern science that you could live to 100 and have a really powerful, meaningful, lovely life.
I mean,
like you can.
I'm three.
It's possible.
I'm 3 years away from when my gran, because of the era she was in.
Went to an old age home.
Finish
work.
Cut her hair short, curl
right,
it,
yeah.
Wear matching floral dress with matching floral shoes. I've got 3 years to go before that if you're looking decades before.
Shit. Yeah, that's scary, hey? Oof. But are the old people, says Carl, going to make the beast with two backs when all is said and done? No, I don't want to imagine that. That's for the Golden Bachelor.
I met someone on the weekend, last mm-hmm. weekend. Remember, I went to a 40th and a 70th.
Yes.
At the 70th, I met someone who works at an old age home, and she says, we've all heard it before, but she's confirmed it.
It's just basically a
she said the
sex
one,
hotel.
Yeah. She said one of the old people came to her and was It was one of the visitors, so one of the children who's like our age.
Right.
Came to her and said, I'm really traumatized. This couple is down the passage and they've left the door open.
They forgot.
And they're going at it and the door is wide open. She said, you won't believe it. And the women don't mind that the men are sleeping with everybody else.
Really?
They've got to look out for STDs. And goodness, there's no like pregnancy scares. And
well, yeah,
she's like
everyone's
that.
All dried up. But isn't that amazing? So they're busy having a full
There's
go.
This resurgence that happens where you're nearing the end of your life and you're like, fuck it. I was faithful
Literally,
to someone.
I'm going to fuck it.
I was faithful to someone for so long. They're gone. They were a bitch. And now I'm going to have some fun.
Wow. Okay. So stuff to look forward to.
Mm.
Like Robert De Niro, like at age 80, just had a baby.
He just had a kid. No, isn't it him and Pacino?
Yeah,
right?
Him and Pacino. Yeah.
Both of them. What? That's amazing. So you know what? Maybe it's not so bad. Maybe the comments here with Matthew, maybe he's right. You actually don't get to decide.
Yeah. Maybe you get that resurgence.
Why the hell not? All right. So quickly, one or two other things that I wanted to get to. Apparently, and we're going to do this antimicrobial awareness week thing just now with Dr. Fatima Patel and Dr. James McDonald, talk a little bit about what's going on in hospitals and what we can do about that. But I want to hear from you this morning. And then you found this interesting story that Snoop Dogg has quit weed.
He says...
No way. I said I'm going to stop drinking in January, right? And I'm not drinking anymore after that, and we'll see how it goes. Because I think there might be health benefits.
Mm.
There definitely will be. But it's not going to be very difficult for me. But Snoop is so attached to the...
30
like he
years.
Is weed, right?
It's who he is.
30 like, years.
I can't imagine Snoop Dogg without weed.
30 years, Gareth. And then he says,
is this
Tupac,
for real?
Yeah, he says Tupac gave him his first blunt, released an entire statement. He's like, he doesn't want personal questions. He wants people to respect his private
wow.
life. But he is quitting officially.
He's not going to be doing weed anymore.
Will he be the same?
Snoop Dogg. I wonder what I wonder why he's decided he won't answer questions about
he
why.
He won't answer questions. It was just the statement and people are coming after him. It's like, no, respect my privacy.
This is the end of an era, everybody. Yeah. I just want to say, if Snoop Dogg is quitting weed, the earth is definitely coming to a close.
The end is nigh.
I know we have medical people who are going to be joining us, so I'm very embarrassed for what I'm about to say if I'm wrong. But mm-hmm. I think his genes have actually taken on weed. And that does even if he stops smoking weed, he'll still always be like he's on weed. He's got like little baby weeds growing in his genes.
I cannot get over this. This is a very bad story. This is upsetting me. Not because I've never even tried weed. I don't like the idea of weed. I hate the smell. But Snoop Dogg, who I've met 3 times in my life, he was high every time.
Yep. He says he's made business deals over a blunt, but he's done.
Oh, unbelievable. This is earth shattering. There's nothing else that I can learn today.
It's like a 7.6 magnitude.
This is big. Oh my God. I don't know if I'm going to get past this bit of news. This is unreal. What are you telling me?
It is happening.
I thought it was a hoax when I saw the headline.
Yeah. It's proper.
Unbelievable. All right, so let's turn our attention to really important things, because although that is important, there are actually bigger things going on in the world. So it is World Antimicrobial Awareness Week from the 18th to the 24th of November, which is right now. And we've got Dr. Fatima Patel, who's a doctor and a medical manager in the medical department at Acino. It's good to have you here. And both of you, let me introduce also Dr. James McDonald, who's a specialist microbiologist currently based at Lancet in Brenthurst. He's an expert on antimicrobials and especially involved in guiding clinicians in hospital practice regarding the appropriate use of antibiotics for hospitalized patients. So both of you are very welcome. It's nice to have you here. And thanks for coming. Yeah, let me switch on your microphones.
I'm listening to Leanne's recall of the golden, the old age home and
yes.
what's happening there.
Oh, yes.
And part of the discussion Dr. McDonald's going to have is about safe sex practices.
Really? That's part of it, huh? Okay, well, very nice to have you both here. So let's just talk about how serious this is, because I don't think a lot of people in South Africa who haven't been in hospital completely understand the danger posed by these microbes and the diseases that are clearly a major, major threat to everyone's well-being. A hospital is a dangerous place, right, Dr. McDonald?
No, definitely. And I just want to say thank you for the platform to raise awareness to this very important issue. So just from some background, so the World Antimicrobial Awareness Week was started by the WHO in 2015, if I remember correctly. And initially it started with antibiotics, as that everyone generally knows, used to treat bacteria, but it's now extended to include antifungals, antivirals, and antiparasitic agents, hence antimicrobial awareness, because unfortunately we are losing the battle on all fronts in some instances.
That's quite scary. Okay, so tell me about antimicrobial resistance, these superbugs.
So antimicrobial resistance is basically when an antimicrobe that's causing infection doesn't respond anymore to the treatment that we currently have or use. And in a way, it is a natural phenomenon because most of our antimicrobials are actually based on natural substances that other organisms make.
Right.
Penicillin, yeah, that's right.
It's made from a mold, and a lot of the antibiotics were actually made by other bacteria. So in a way, it's a natural way for these organisms to survive in their niche environments. You know, one organism kills them off and they develop a way to survive that so they can also share and thrive in that niche. Unfortunately, with the advent of mass use of antimicrobial agents, the organisms are doing what they do best and they survive.
Yeah, they evolve to survive.
Versatile and adaptive.
Yeah. Okay, so how big is the problem worldwide?
So there are data globally available. There is a lot of surveillance programs ongoing. The WHO, for example, has what they call the GLASS surveillance programs.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that in a lot of countries, especially lower or middle income countries, we don't always have the figures or the numbers, because if we're not testing the antimicrobial agents against the vast array of pathogens, we actually don't know how big the problem is. What we do know, it's a global problem, and it unfortunately the countries hardest hit is the sub-Saharan African countries and Southeast Asian countries. That seems to be where the problem is a lot. Unfortunately, if you grow up in poverty, you already have poor sanitation, the problem is going to escalate from there, unfortunately.
Sure. Okay, so how did we get to this stage? Is it because people didn't complete their course of antibiotics like we learn? I mean, some of those obviously are part of the problem. But we can't develop medicines fast enough.
That is part of the problem, definitely. So it's a combination of things. Once we have this huge evolutionary or pressure that we're exerting because we're using so much antimicrobials in the environment, we're using it not only in humans. I mean, obviously the hospitals is a big problem, but we need to see it as a larger, what they call a One Health approach. So everyone who's involved or a role player in antimicrobials, and that includes the general public, that includes us as the medical fraternity, veterinarians, production animal use, they use a lot of antimicrobials. I mean, these get eventually released into the environment and we have that pressure building up. So that's one part of the problem. The next problem that we have is unfortunately the global boom in population across the world.
Yeah.
Combine that with international travel.
So they spread faster, quicker.
So a good case and example that we have here currently in South Africa is an enzyme called the NDM, the New Delhi metallobeta-lactamase. It was named after New Delhi because that's where it was picked up when a patient went there for treatment and went back home. So we are seeing a lot of that currently in South Africa as well. And it has to do with the global travel that we see.
Yeah.
Patients get colonized with these organisms. I mean, you go on to your next week. You might not be ill, but the organism is inside your gut as well. You're carrying it around with you. So wherever you're going, that organism is going as well. All you need is then to get admitted into a hospital, for example, into a foreign country, and then that organism takes niche inside that hospital as well.
And also resistance genes, they can pass them on to other organisms as well.
They spread it as well. So you'll have a pool, let's say, for example, maybe a silly example, but you have a basin inside a hospital where everyone washes their hands, they pour their coffee or their soft drinks in there that they don't use. That's a nice niche environment for organisms to start replicating. So now you introduce one organism that's very resistant. It has a lot of resistance enzymes and mechanisms attached to it. It's inside that basin. And it's spreading that, what's called the mobile element. Most of the time it's a little plasmid. It's a circular string of DNA, basically, that has all these genes for resistance on it.
Yeah.
And it's able to spread that onto the next organism and into the next organism. So organisms that essentially weren't resistant from the start can get or acquire all these resistance mechanisms.
You know, Dr. Patel, we were talking when you were in our office the other day about the story of this one guy who started suggesting that people should wash their hands. and that that was the source of, and this is in what, the late 1800s, early 1900s, somewhere around there, and how that started getting people conscientized to the fact that actually, and they called him lunatic. I mean, they put him in a mental asylum eventually because he was saying, wash your hands, which now we take for granted, right?
It could be like someone saying to you now, you must wash your ears, otherwise you're going to spread germs. We'd be like, are you insane? What are you,
yeah, crazy. So, I mean, that's where it all started. And then, of course, we had Alexander Fleming and we had penicillin and we had all of this stuff. But it feels to me like this is something very, very serious because we don't actually have the means to get ahead of this curve. And if you catch one of these diseases, what, you got a 50-50 chance?
Depends on the organism, depends on your state as well.
Sure.
So I think it's a lot of factors that need to take into consideration. But unfortunately, the patients who suffer the most from antimicrobial resistance are the ones who have it on the back foot already. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the premature neonates in ICUs who already have next to nothing immune system. They
immunocompromised people.
And oncology patients, for example, unfortunately. And then patients who...
Immunocompromised patients.
Yeah. We were in an accident and ended up in the ICU for months on end. And they're going to rehab and to step downs. And unfortunately, all those organisms are there. So, I mean, you might not start off with a problem that is essentially driven or based on antimicrobial resistance, but eventually down the line, it might become your problem.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I look at my mum who had a stroke and she was in neuro ICU for almost a year. And the reason, one of the biggest reasons why she couldn't get out was because she kept on contracting superbugs and, you know, various infections due to the equipment that was being used. And it was just unavoidable. Everyone had the same issue. And then developing resistance to the antibiotics to the point where they had to bring in antibiotics from overseas that hadn't been used here yet.
The most effective medicine is preventive medicine, actually.
No, definitely. And, you know, I think that's hence the importance of this week as a whole, because unfortunately, antimicrobial resistance at one point or another, you might be as fit and healthy as you are now. Down the line, it's going to become your problem. It's going to become your children's problem. And I think that's the whole aim, is just to spread that awareness so that everyone knows that everyone has a role to play.
Okay, so what can we do? Yeah. What can you do to prevent and to create, you know, a safer environment with less contamination in general? What can we do?
So I think that's a very important question, because a lot of what we've been doing, me as a clinical microbiologist, a lot of what we've been doing has been geared towards other healthcare professionals in the hospital. And I think the public at large has been left out into the education, the awareness of it. So I think an important factor, as was mentioned earlier, is the prevention of infections in the first place. I mean, we can try and live as healthy as we can so that we don't need to end up going to hospital. And it's just not about things like washing your hands. It's a very important thing, definitely. But other factors like preparing your food properly. Mm-hmm. You know, don't get that bacterial stomach bug that go to your general practitioner, pops a few pills to you and sends you on your merry way. I mean, let's try and prevent the use of antimicrobials in the first place. Mm. Safe sexual practices, definitely. I mean,
especially in those old age homes.
Because, I mean, what do we use to treat sexually acquired infections? We use antimicrobials.
Absolutely.
And we're not using, unfortunately, those organisms are becoming very resistant as well, like gonococcus.
Those gonococcus. And before you know it, your cock is gone.
Because we use very broad spectrum antimicrobials to treat them, which are actually meant to be treating other infections with.
But okay, so where did we go wrong here? Because for thousands of years, you know, people have obviously been infected and have caught things and died, but we were able to, at least for the last 100 or 200 years, kind of get in front of this thing. What's happened?
I mean, sanitation improved, that we improved on, and that's
that should be helping us to even get further ahead. Instead, it seems like in the hospitals, which are, you would think, some of the cleaner, more sterile places, there's extra care taken in theater, for example, to make sure that there's less chance that you get infections there. But turns out hospitals are like petri dishes for this stuff.
It goes back to what you were saying earlier, Gareth. People are living longer. We're living longer.
Yeah.
They're older and they are more vulnerable. They're the ones who are sick in ICUs, in hospitals.
Yeah.
Dr. McDonald will attest to that. He sees that in the hospitals as well.
I mean, because hospitals, unfortunately, have that propensity to have these very resistant organisms because of all the antimicrobials that are being used.
Yeah.
You've created such a selective pressure that the ones who have the most resistant mechanisms are the ones who are going to survive. And unfortunately, we just haven't kept up in terms of antimicrobial development. And there's various reasons for that, unfortunately, as well. I think a big thing is just the costs involved with developing and testing and getting an antimicrobial approved, only for it, for organisms to become resistant to it a year later after it's released. Jeez. So
it's hard all over again.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, so we just haven't been able to keep up. So I think from the preventative point of view, I mean, if we can limit the amount of antimicrobials used, I mean, it's, but for the general public, that's not something necessarily that they decide on. I mean, you go to your general practitioner, I mean, you come with your presenting complaints, and I mean, most of the time, antimicrobial gets the written
I think my dad's fridge is largely to blame as well.
Just your dad's fridge.
Since my mom doesn't have control of the kitchen anymore, he's one of those people who saves everything.
Uh-oh.
And then with load shedding.
Yeah, but that's not going to create super bugs.
I wouldn't be surprised.
You should hope.
He also believes that any mold grown on cheese is fine.
So who are the susceptible patient groups here?
Unfortunately, all of us at the end of the day are going to be affected by it. But unfortunately, as we said earlier, it's those neonates that have no other option. They were born prematurely. They're going to spend their time in hospital for a long time before they're well enough to go home. It's your oncology patients who get immunosuppressive therapy in any case as well. Yeah. They're very prone to getting these types of infections because also they spend a long time in hospital. It's your ICU patients who can't take care of themselves.
Your post-surgical patients, all the post-surgical patients as well.
I mean, it's a tragedy if you go in for an elective procedure only to be taken down by a resistant organism in the hospital afterwards.
That's it.
Mm. I mean, I used to say as well, you know, for students and things, you know, when you give lectures and things, you can aspire to be the best surgeon in the world. And you can be the best in the world, skill-wise. But at the end of the day, the great equalizer is going to be the antimicrobial resistant organisms. And it affects all spheres of medicine as well. There's very few disciplines where antibiotics isn't involved in patient care at one time or another.
And it's so weird how we just lean on it. We lean on antibiotics. We trust that they'll save us for everything. I mean, I went in for a hip replacement 3 months ago. And, you know, before you decide to do the surgery, again, an elective surgery, the surgeon will say, you know, infection is a risk. And you put that at the bottom of your priorities. All you're thinking about is the surgery and the benefits. You know that if you get an infection, something will save you. But sometimes it can't.
You know, you've got antibiotics on hand.
Yeah.
People underestimate that not all antibiotics work against all the bugs.
Exactly.
I was going to say, doctor, like, I think in terms of preventing and like preventative medicine, education is always the key. People need to know why they need an antimicrobial or an antibiotic. People need to know that and understand what a broad spectrum antibiotic is and why they shouldn't be taking
this. So what is that? Let's define those things, because most of us are not in the medical field at all. So what's a broad spectrum antibiotic as opposed to a more specialized?
No, that's a very good question, definitely. No. So when you talk about broad spectrum antimicrobial, so we get different bacteria causing infections, and there's thousands of them. We can basically divide them on how they look under a microscope with a certain stain, and we call that the Gram stain. So we have Gram-positive organisms and we have Gram-negative organisms. So in terms of antimicrobials, we have antimicrobials that are able to cover Gram-positives and Gram-negatives. And we have antibiotics that are able to only cover Gram-positives in some cases, or only Gram-negatives. But then it becomes more complicated as resistance mechanisms start piling up. Now you have an antimicrobial that's able to cover both of those organisms and an extended spectrum of organisms of the Gram-negatives, for example. So that's why, hence, broad spectrum. So you try and cover as much of the antibiotics.
So you actually don't know what's going on there, but you're going to try and hit it with this thing that...
In a lot of cases, that's how antimicrobials are started in a hospital. You have a patient who has become terribly sick. You're suspecting there's an infection involved. You don't know what organism it is yet. So you use broad spectrum coverage because you want to cover as much as possible until you can get an answer. And that's usually where a clinical microbiologist in the lab comes in. So samples from the patient will be sent and we'll try and grow the organism causing the infection. We'll test it against all the antimicrobials that we can test for, and then we advise according to that. And then based on those results, we would like the clinicians to de-escalate, meaning that now that we know this is the organism and it's sensitive to these antimicrobials, you're using something that's well fit for purpose, but too broad.
Yeah.
So rather use something else that's a bit more narrower.
And Dr. Fatima, what about like doctors? Do they have a role here because they are over-prescribing?
Absolutely. No. Most patients go to the GP with a sniffle and they immediately expect an antibiotic.
Right.
So I think GPs are responsible for educating the public and their patients as well. That it's not an antibiotic is not always required if you just have a simple sniffle or you don't have any factors that predispose you to a more severe infection. For example, if you're not an older patient or a diabetic patient or a patient with a cardiac condition.
Yeah.
Young, healthy, 20-year-old, and you've got a sniffle and you say to the doctor, I want an antibiotic. I think the GPs are, the responsibility lies with them to educate their patients.
Yeah.
Yeah. They know their patients and the ones that come in and will demand an antibiotic.
Yes.
And won't feel satisfied unless they get that. And I mean, it can be something as simple as having some paracetamol and bed rest.
Yes, that's exactly what they need. Sometimes a sniffle is just as a result of your immune system having broken down and your body's tired. You just need a bit of rest, something to just deal with the symptoms. You don't need.
What about environmental stuff? Because when we're pumping all of these antimicrobial drugs into the environment, into the water supply, I mean, you mentioned, you know, like the basin, the drain, all of that stuff. It's also emboldening, in inverted commas, all of these other microbial agents to develop in ways that they wouldn't have had to before.
No, definitely.
Right? So it's in the system.
That's where the One Health approach comes in as well, because obviously a lot of the antimicrobials we as humans consume, that ends up in the environment as well because we exclude it in our urine or it goes into the stool, into the sewage systems.
Right.
And that's where all the bacteria are. But antimicrobials are also being used in veterinary care and they're being used in animal production as well as growth promoters because you don't want to add this big animal you're going to slaughter it in the day. You don't want it to get an infection and then die off prematurely.
Yeah.
So antimicrobials are added to the food and so forth, and these get excreted into the environment, and most of them end up into the river systems as well as effluent from the farms and so forth.
We really have very little control of what's going on in the world.
So Dave says, this is so much better than having celebrities on the show. A pity so many will find the life-saving stuff as being boring. I don't think this is boring at all. I think this is fascinating.
Scary.
And it saddens me that so many people in the medical field understand this thing, but people outside of it have no idea.
I think a lot, looking at the literature now, especially during this week, obviously everyone is talking about antimicrobial resistance. So a large portion of what we're trying to improve on is actually to deliver it to a level that the general public can appreciate and understand and, well, as quoted, boring.
Make it's not boring. I think it's fascinating. Carl says, my mom has been in hospital for over 2 months with an infection that the antibiotics just cannot kill. They check her CRP levels every day, cannot get CRP below 50. It's been horrible, he says. Well, he says it's been fun. But he does say his mom is fat and old and the bug in her just won't go away. Now that she's at a rehab center, she's trying to learn to walk again. I mean, that's tough. What do you do? Mm-hmm. What do you do? I mean, eventually the doctors go, well, we've tried all of this stuff.
You run out of stuff.
So how hard are the pharmaceutical companies working to try and develop new drugs?
At the moment, there's such a challenge to develop these new drugs. I don't think they've found candidates that are suitable as antimicrobials, antibiotics. Remember, when they're looking for candidates at the chemical level, they got identified in natural substances or find it. They go through a range of screening for these things. I don't think they've found enough of these to satisfy the criteria to promote it to the next stages in clinical development. So at that point, you've already got a limitation. And then going through the clinical process, it can fail anywhere along the clinical process in any phase of the studies. So a lot of them fail before they even get to the final phase 3, phase 4 part of the clinical development.
I mean, we're trying to kill things. That's actually what we're talking about, right? We're trying to kill.
It's a war.
Yeah, it's a war. This is like a proper full-on war. This is like you've got to bomb the things into submission.
Yes.
Then one or two of them creep back out and they survive because now they're battle-hardened. They come back for more. Are there any chemicals that can just kill anything that's living that you can use in a hospital? I mean, we talk about bleach, for example.
Well, those machines, those little robots that come in and zap the room. Yeah.
So that's
what can we do?
So that's a big component of what the preventative arm in trying to resolve this AMR crisis is that we need obviously clean environments. So we use our disinfectants in the environment itself to try and lower the burden of these drug-resistant organisms. I don't think you'll completely get rid of them. at all. A big focus now on new research has been the drains, for example.
Yeah.
We can't really say how much of a role they play in spreading infections. There's been a few studies that have shown or linked them positively. You know, we've isolated this organism from these patients and we found it in the
Because, I mean, you just trap. Put some sodium hydroxide down there. It
yes.
kills everything,
yes, Donald
right?
Trump. Just inject it.
No, sodium hydroxide in the drain will clear it out.
So the problem is the biofilm that they form. Mm. So they form, they secrete these extracellular proteins and meshes, and they actually stick to the surface of that drain pipe. And they form this thick slimy layer. So whatever you're throwing down there, it's not actually going to reach and kill them off as well. And that's exactly the same problem that we have infections in humans, is they form these biofilm as well. So now you have an antibiotic that, number one, can't reach the organism to kill it off with. And secondly, as they lower their metabolic rates as well. And a lot of the antimicrobials that we use are actually designed or meant to work in an actively dividing organism. So
high
and
metabolic
that's where,
rates.
Yeah,
wow.
so they become, they know they've outsmarted us. It's a game of chess and they're always 3-4 moves
and
ahead.
And there's so many millions of more of them than there are of us.
Yes. The biofilm is a big problem because you see that a lot of prosthetics.
Yeah, prosthetic joint infections.
I had that when I had my collarbone.
What happened to your collarbone?
I got thrown off a horse. It broke. They put a plate. It got infected. There was massive biofilm. They had to take the plates out, and then the bone broke all over again. And,
No, that's the only way to get rid of it, unfortunately, is to remove the prosthesis. And that's not a feasible thing in someone who's a hip replacement or a joint replacement.
Yes, Leanne, you better look out.
I'm telling you, that's the thing. That I was being discharged.
That's
and,
what you're most worried about.
And a guy was readmitted. He had an infection. They had to take everything out and start again. Mm. I mean, you think about it. I've done it a few times where you open up your sink drain. Mm. Yeah, I know it's horrible. But you think it looks so clean from the outside and you put down that hydroxide, whatever, bleach stuff and you think it's working. There's that massive film around that pipe that
the actual YouTube.
Unless it's scraped away, you're not going to get anywhere. With your bleach
or whatever.
Slimy
looking.
Yeah.
Oh my God, this is disgusting. I don't want to go and look for that. I'd rather not. Okay, so here's a comment from, sorry, I'll let you go now, Buckabunter. You've actually got some more specialized questions for this. Chris says, I'm 34 and I've never taken antibiotics and I've never been sick. Is that possible? I think he's lying.
I don't think the part about never being sick. It's possible if you've never taken an antibiotic, but as a child, does he know when he took anything as a child, as a baby?
Because, of course, there's no absolute here, right? I mean, there's always going to be a need. I've taken antibiotics in my life, but I don't go looking for them every time I'm sick. So there's a happy medium. It has to be.
And that's where I think patient education, again, is the general public as well. It's that health-seeking behavior. I mean, we have to know that for a viral infection, like a sniffle or a runny nose, antibiotics don't work. So don't go to your GP expecting antimicrobials and being unhappy if he doesn't write it up or he or she doesn't write it up. And then you go on to the next GP. Start doctor shopping till you find what you're looking for. I mean,
that's where the GP's role becomes really critical in educating patients and not pandering to every request for an antibiotic.
Mm. Yeah, because a lot of the time doctors, especially in America, the patient goes to the doctor and says, I want this drug because they advertise in America. They don't do it here.
Yeah, it's a problem, especially in places where you don't require a prescription for antibiotics and they're getting it without a prescription in some countries.
Really?
So they're on demand. Patients are just getting antibiotics on demand.
We don't have that here, though.
We don't have that here, no.
You have to be prescribed the antibiotics.
There are some unscrupulous pharmacists who will dispense for people who they don't know.
Really?
Or mostly people I hope they know, but it does happen.
Unscrupulous pharmacists. We need to know about these people. What did you want to ask, Buckabunter?
I was going to say, let's just blame the doctor prescribing recklessly. Also, finish your antibiotics. It's the easiest thing you can do.
You know, we're starting to go into a new phase as well, because a lot of what we know and how antibiotics were used were based on old digmas, and we're starting to learn better. So there's a lot of research actually going into using shorter courses of antimicrobials. And we're finding that, you know, infections that we used to treat for 14 days, a bloodstream infection, for example, can now be safely treated with 5 to 7 days.
Really?
There are some exceptions to the rules that we actually find we need to use them longer. But in general, there is this big movement of using shorter courses of antimicrobials.
And the less duration of exposure to the antimicrobial, the better the chances of developing resistance.
That's what drives resistance, is these long, prolonged courses in a single patient, unfortunately.
Okay, then, Doctor, to a South African context, how does this apply to like XDR and MDR, like multi-drug resistant TB. And
so we've made some nice developments from there, and South Africa has been a global leader in this as well. Mm. We have new regimens that we're now being able to treat drug resistant TB on, and they're oral antibiotics, so you don't have a patient needing to sit in the hospital with a drip or getting it shot in the bum, for example, intramuscularly or so. And it's a shorter course than we traditionally have been used because we just have better agents to treat them with now.
Wow. Okay, well, listen, I've learned an enormous amount. Leanne, you're lucky you got out alive after your hip replacement. Well, that's all I'm going
to
say.
I've got to go back for the other ones now. Oh. Yeah. But, you know, even there, they give you special gels to shower with for up to 3 days before and on the morning of, fresh pajamas, fresh sheets at, in your own home. You're not allowed to, you know, wear anything twice. So there's a lot of prevention that goes on as well when it comes to elective surgery.
Sure.
And another area besides hand washing, I think another area in the home is food preparation.
Yeah. Mm.
Where a lot of our antimicrobials develop all sorts
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so as the seasons change, we'll pick up that we're seeing a lot of more of the gastrointestinal organisms, Salmonella, Shigella. Staph can definitely cause some horrible food poisoning as well. So just to prepare and store your food safely so that you don't end up needing antimicrobials down the line, because that's also one of the, next to a runny nose, it's a runny tummy that sends people to the GP.
There's a question that's, send social media into a frenzy every time, and that's, should you wash your raw chicken before cooking it or not? Because the one argument is you need to rid it of certain bacteria, that's why you need to wash it. The other is, if you're washing it, you're now placing more bacteria in your sink and you on your hands and then on the cloth. Do you not just pop that stuff in the pot?
You know, it's all about cooking. So chicken, obviously, as everyone knows, that's the one thing that needs to be cooked properly. It doesn't matter where you buy your chicken from the high retail store to or onto the street next to the side of the road. Chickens carry pathogens. So it needs to be cooked properly to a proper temperature to kill them off. I think what some people maybe make mistakes on is the cutting board in which you cut your chicken.
Yes.
Don't use that now for cutting your veggies afterwards for your salad or something like that.
Or for your potato salad. Don't use the same knives for cutting the chicken that you use for the potatoes.
So that's cross-contamination.
Well. Yeah. I remember when I was a medical student, a lecturer for one of our microbiology lectures, he says, often it's these big functions where all the grannies get together and making all the things afterward and all too many hands touching the food and things. And that's why people often have staph infections after this, and you get that acute vomiting after a wedding or a funeral where people have.
Yeah, so that's a toxin that it produces that makes you ill.
So I think that's saying too many cooks spoil the broth. I think that's too many hands also can spoil the food.
Yeah, there we go.
So how do you clean that chopping board? Because now I'm thinking about my chopping board at home.
And is it plastic? Is it wood? It's plastic.
Yeah. No, so just a good wipe down with some household bleach that's diluted. You know, just follow the manufacturer's recommendations of the strength of it. I mean, that's one thing that my bacterium things won't necessarily develop resistance to. It's because it works in a completely different way. Yeah. It's not like an antibiotic.
It's an inorganic chemical.
And if you can, separate chopping boards for separate foods like meats and veggies and knives.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to go home and now completely sterilize my entire house.
Your kitchen is fine. Don't worry.
Oh, I'm so nervous now. I promise you, these things drive me into like a state of panic. I don't like the idea of
you'll be fine. How often
salmonella
have you been
on the cutting board? Yeah. This is really upsetting to me.
Sick. How often have you been sick from food?
No.
Exactly.
Hardly ever.
So you've got nothing to worry about.
Sure.
I just think I have a stomach made of concrete. Something's going on there. All right. Well, I think this is all very, very useful information. And thank you both, Dr. Fatima, Dr. McDonald. Thank you both for coming here to talk to us this morning. I think that we probably have no idea of like the severity of this thing. And we've got to try in our own little ways to keep these infections from spreading. Because, I mean, it's just, you don't want to end up in a hospital. If you could possibly help it, stay out of a hospital.
Yes.
And don't let the doctor just keep prescribing antibiotics to you if you don't need them.
Yeah. I think the preventative, washing hands, good hygiene, good health care.
Right.
And don't take antibiotics unnecessarily.
Don't be a filthy pig.
Am I right? Dirty pig.
Yeah, dirty pig.
Dirty pig.
Yeah, right. Thank you very much. It's great to have you here.
You,
so
thank you so
there
much.
We go. There's a little bit of useful info for you on this Monday morning from Dr. James McDonald and Dr. Fatima Patel. They can also, we'll put all the information up on cliffcentral.com. Have an awesome Monday, everybody, and make sure you clean everything around you all the time. It'll make you all paranoid, but you have to be on top of these things. Thanks, everybody. See you on tomorrow morning's show, 6 o'clock. cliffcentral.com